Nakul, the court.
Bonjour, veuillez vous asseoir.
Please be seated. In the matter of the Attorney General of Quebec versus Pequa Kamlounouch Tekuikan, for the appellant, or rather for today, it's for the intervener, the Attorney General of Canada, Francoise Royal, Marc Ribeiro, and Marie-Ève Robillard.
Ontario. David Tortel, Charles Ains McCulloch, for the intervener, Attorney General of Saskatchewan, R. James Fife Casey, for the intervener, Attorney General of Alberta, Krista Epton, Angela Edginton, pour l'intervenant, Assemblée des Premières Nations, Québec-Labrador.
For the intervener, the Assembly of First Nations, Quebec-Labrador, Marie-Ève Dumont, Jamila Giroux-Burkhan, Sarah Andrade, Wade Macaulay.
For the intervener, Congress of Aboriginal Peoples, Linus Awi. For the intervener, Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, Nick Saunders and Carly Fox. For the intervener, Indigenous Police Chiefs of Ontario, Julian N. Falconer, Asha James, Jeremy Greenberg, and Shelby Percival. For the intervener, First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada, Naomi Metelik and Logan Stack. For the intervener, Okanagan Indian Band, Claire Truesdale and Mary Molly Churchill. For the intervener, Assembly of First Nations, Julie McGregor. Maître Royal.
Alors, bon matin, Monsieur le juge en chef.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Before we start, Mr. Joël, I have some clarifications to seek. You are acting as intervener in this case. In principle, you cannot make comments on the merits of the case. Simply submit general information, just like any other intervener. You were a party in the matter at the Court of Appeal. Now you've become an intervener. We may need explanations. This may enable us to have a more coherent trial as well. Answer. We take note of your comments, Chief Justice. I understand this is a special case. When it comes to explanations, I started by saying that the Attorney General of Canada decided not to submit leave for submissions. I can't go into details about the reasons, but I can only tell you this. We must consider or distinguish the role of the Attorney General as a party. And I think we also need to distinguish the role of the Attorney General as a representative of public interest that chooses to be an intervener to plead on general matters of law. So looking at the general framework of reconciliation, that is an important objective for the government. This could lead the Attorney General to reconcile certain matters, as is the case here. But right now, we have understood your comments. We will stick to general comments of law, and we will not be taking any position on the merits of the case. I hope you are satisfied. Question. Not really. I'm speaking for myself. When we want to have the best of both worlds, that's what happened. We are here, 9 judges of the Supreme Court. We are hearing a very important case, and I see the Attorney General before us, and I'm not too sure of the cap he's wearing. So we have to be deciding on very serious matters. Should we consider you a party to the case or an intervener? If You are an intervener. Your presence will be very limited. Answer, yes, indeed. We chose not to seek leave to appeal. That was a choice that we made and will assume the consequences. So that's why we are appearing as an intervener, and we'll be pleading only on general matters of law, and that's a role that the Attorney General of Canada has accepted to play. Go ahead. As we've seen in the submissions you have before us, we are presenting three proposals today. We are saying that the honor of the Crown could be engaged when the Crown makes a commitment as part of an unconstitutional contract according to Section 35. Secondly, we are saying that if the honor of the Crown applies, in such a case, the Crown may be bound by commitment of diligence in specific cases. And thirdly, if there's any breach by the Crown, there are appropriate remedies to encourage the parties to negotiate the best way of attaining the objective of reconciliation. Let me start with my first point, a general point on the type of situation where the honor of the Crown could be engaged. We are saying that the current jurisprudence of this court allows recognition of the fact that the honor of the Crown could apply where there's an unconstitutional contract. We know that historically it was taken for granted when we're dealing with an unconstitutional matter, the honor of the Crown will apply. But now, when we see this as a government policy or an agreement, it is allowed that the honor of the Crown could apply when the Crown makes a commitment to implement the right to self-government as protected by Section 35. We think this is appropriate for three reasons at least. This court did not hear the category of cases. I'm referring to the Manitoba Mati decision, paragraph 73. Secondly, in Ida, the court was clear that the honor of the Crown is an important principle, and I'm insisting on the word, must receive generous interpretation to attain its objective. And thirdly, this was a decision referred to yesterday where relying on the recent opinion of this court in the reference on indigenous services to indigenous kids. The court in that case referred to a law that did two things, in among other things, reaffirming the existence of a right to self-government and also ensured that the accession bound the Crown based on the combined role of the provisions. The court said the honor of the Crown could be engaged, and that could be found in the reference in tab 7 in our condensed book. Question, Mr. Joyal, are you saying that we are dealing with a case like that in the reference with a law that concerns an inherent right to self-government? Answer, we are not dealing with the same thing. It's a law that reaffirms the right to self-government. What we are saying is that the reason still applies, because if the Crown, without being forced by law to do so, as is the case in the reference, makes a commitment under a policy to implement the right to self-government, that could suffice for the honor of the Crown to be engaged and obligations could be imposed. In this case, the Crown is not bound by law but made a commitment. Question, Mr. Joyal, if it's not the Constitution, if it's not Section 35, which is the criterion that leads to implementation or engages the honor of the Crown, as you said, is an unconstitutional commitment, could lead to that commitment. So all unconstitutional commitments cannot stick the honor of the Crown. According to you, what legal criterion will allow the Crown to determine unconstitutional obligations for which the honor of the crown should apply and those for which the honor of the crown will not apply? Answer, I will say two things. First of all, when it comes to the criterion, let me repeat what I said before. I believe that when the Crown makes a commitment to implement the right to self-government, and I'm citing this law because it's related to the case, it's a Section 35 right, and that's our position. We have an element that is constitutional that allows engagement of the honor of the Crown. Beyond that, we need express commitment. I think that would be important. Besides the link to a law under Section 35 that has to do with self-government, we refer to the fact that we were talking about reconciliation with pre-existing Aboriginal communities. So that element can also be considered. It's still present in cases that concern the honor of the crown. We've talked about the idea of solemnity. Maybe we should not expect that in all cases. This takes me to my second point. Okay. I think that when it comes to the content, well, in some cases, we could consider the honor of the crown can apply. Looking at the content, the fact that it's an unconstitutional commitment could have a different consequence. And I'm going beyond what you asked. Talking about criteria, I think I will refer you to what I said before. If I may continue, I will go now to my second point to talk about the content. Question. Does the rule or is the objective of this policy to respect reconciliation?
Ça va dépendre de chaque.
Answer, it would depend on each case. I cannot go beyond general considerations. I think we should need to consider the different factors. We need an express consideration that is tied to implementation of the right to self-government that is protected under Section 35. And looking at that constitutional angle, that could enable us to consider the question. I'm also referring to other parameters that I provided when I was answering other questions. To go on with the content, inaudible for the interpreter. The question is inaudible for the interpreter.
Entre, premièrement, les négociations pour entrer dans un contrat initial versus les négociations pour renouveler les contrats par la suite. Est-ce qu'il y a une différence?
Mais là, on est sur le contenu.
Answer, we are talking about the content. I think there could be a difference depending on the case. We need to look at the circumstances of each case. So beyond that answer, I think we need to consider each circumstance. There could be, well, it's always an obligation of diligence that should apply in all cases. And I'm looking at the Manitoba Métis ruling, where the court decided that an obligation of diligence had to apply. I think it's the same case that should apply here generally. An obligation to adopt an approach, and there's also the obligation to act diligently to fulfill the promise. So there's an obligation of diligence. Now, to answer your question, what does diligence require? It depends on each case. Would this require a certain behavior before negotiations start versus during renewal? We should consider all facts. We need to consider all aspects of the case. In this case, I'll try to stick to generalities, but we need to consider all instruments that are involved in the case. I said I wanted to deal with three points. I'll end with the issue of remedies, beyond the question of knowing whether the honor of the crown was respected or not, when we talk about the honor of the crown, the court has been clear that it's not a cause of action, as was stated yesterday. It's an obligation that has to do with the terms and conditions of obligations that engage the honor of the crown. I think that's an important consequence. And we have jurisprudence where we are saying that the main objective is reconciliation. Question, I would like to know, would the declaration be an appropriate remedy because you've already paid your part? Answer, now we are getting into the details of the case. I don't want to take any position as to know whether a declaratory judgment will have been appropriate in this case. So we are speaking about generalities that have to do with the honor of the crown, and to say that it could be a remedy. Let's take the case before us. This is a continuous relationship in time. We need to promote solutions that enable the relationship to flourish and continue. So we need to define the obligations of the crown so that in the future we could reestablish the nation-to-nation relationship. Thank you.
David Tortell.
Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. There was discussion at the hearing yesterday and again just a few moments ago regarding the scope and function of the honor of the crown as applied to the tripartite agreement in this case and more broadly. And Ontario's submissions are intended to briefly contribute to this discussion. Given that the crown Indigenous agreements are concluded across Canada, deal with many issues and come in many forms, our submissions today will more broadly address Crown Indigenous agreements outside the treaty context and will not focus on Quebec law specifically. Ontario submits that the honor of the Crown, if and where engaged by a valid Crown Indigenous agreement entered into by sophisticated parties, is not a tool for revising the terms of that agreement. And Ontario takes no position on the merits of the appeal. So it's clear everybody will agree that the Crown, in contracting with Indigenous parties, cannot act in bad faith.
Right.
In
now, its... now you used the word the Crown, and I understand that. But of course, we have the Crown in right of Canada, and then we have the Crown in right of each of the provinces. They are not one and the same, are they?
Thank you, Justice Rowe. They are not one and the same, but for the purpose of these submissions, I'm referring, generally speaking, to the Crown, federal or provincial. Of course, I represent Ontario, so I'm speaking for Ontario. Don't purport to speak for anyone else with respect to the creation of such agreements at issue in the case. As was suggested yesterday by members of the court, the doctrine of good faith within and outside of Canada is effective in promoting proper Crown conduct in this regard. And Ontario would simply note in this regard, the doctrine is robust, it's flexible, and it is very well established and would help to ensure certainly that the Crown, in entering into agreements with Indigenous parties, will respect its corresponding obligations. Applying the honor of the Crown to non-treaty Crown Indigenous agreements, which are routinely entered into, could have significant implications going forward. And that said, if this court were to find that the honor of the Crown does play a role in this context, Ontario submits that any such role should not allow either parties or the courts to rely on this doctrine to revise the terms mapped out in these agreements. This point is consistent with decisions of this court underlining the need to respect the written terms or handiwork of modern treaties. It likewise aligns with other appellate decisions rooted in Supreme Court of Canada case law, which make the same point in relation to treaty land entitlement agreements. The honor of the crown speaks to how obligations that attract it must be fulfilled. It is a normative doctrine, best understood as a framing rather than a reframing device. And there are several reasons why this doctrine should not be used as a tool for revising agreement terms. First and foremost, doing so would undermine finality and predictability for parties to an agreement. It could likewise disincentivize the signing of agreements. It could complicate the agreement drafting process itself, and even in certain situations, it could possibly trigger litigation. Specifically, in the context of the judicial review of Crown Indigenous agreements,
Excuse me, sorry.
Yes.
I realize you're in full flight. I apologize for cutting you off. So I'm interested in your comment on the honor of the crown being the manner in which the obligations are performed. And I'm wondering if, and I realize you're not speaking to Quebec law, but that the manner in which the obligations are performed in respect of contracts with First Nations also has to abide by the strictures of performing obligations or contractual undertakings in good faith.
Thank you, Justice Kazira. Absolutely. We have no difficulty with the proposition, of course, that any activity by the Crown in the context of undertaking agreement or contract obligations would necessarily be informed by good faith. I understand, I'm not an expert, of course, but I do understand that in Quebec, the good faith obligation perhaps is somewhat more plenary, but I also understand, and as per Madam Justice Martin's, Moreau, I believe's comments yesterday, the common law doctrine of good faith likewise is expanding. So I do take your point and would certainly agree that, like the honor of the, you know, it is another framing device which would certainly inform Crown conduct in the context
Thank
of
you.
Undertaking agreement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Fife.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to focus my submissions on the issue of courts relying on the honor of the crown to effectively rewrite the terms of agreements between the crown and Indigenous peoples. We've had this debate in Saskatchewan in relation to our treaty land entitlement agreements, and which I'll call TLE agreements for short. In its factum, Saskatchewan reviews TLE cases in which courts have held that the honor of the crown should not be used to rewrite the agreements. And we urge this court to be guided by those cases, or at the very least to avoid disturbing the certainty provided by them.
But may I just intercede here? In the four cases that you discuss in your factum, don't they all recognize that the honor of the crown does apply in the kind of situation you're describing? And you're just saying, well, it does apply, but don't let it apply to the extent to rewrite the agreement. But don't the cases work in the manner in which they're being presented?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And if I could just draw a distinction between the TLE context and what we're dealing with today. In the treaty land entitlement context, there are clear constitutional anchors from which the honor of the crown is derived in informing how the agreements must be performed. In the present matter, not so much. It appears to be, from my understanding of the court's reasons below, based more on a federal policy, which of course could be changed. Different government could get rid of it altogether. That's nowhere near the sort of solid constitutional anchor that would be a basis for finding an honorable obligation. Let me proceed to just...
When we have a treaty land entitlement, though, there is also, as you know, a distinct body of law that says when we're dealing with modern treaties and negotiated between sophisticated parties, that they are to be respected effectively, that the there to be there's a degree of deference to what the parties have agreed to. So it is that context that also applies. I mean, the principle you've stated, and that was stated by Ontario, that the honour of the Crown isn't the basis to rewrite agreements. I mean, that's a pretty trite point, but it's really in the application of a specific context, because we also know that the honour of the Crown can't be contracted out of, right? So, I mean, these are generalities at the end of the day that don't really help resolve a particular situation.
I do agree, but unfortunately, it is an issue that keeps arising. So, for example, in the treaty land entitlement context, we've experienced 8 separate pieces of litigation in which TLE bands have sought to effectively rewrite the agreements with terms based on the honor of the Crown. So it is very much a real life concern that we're dealing with in Saskatchewan, which is one of the very reasons why we've intervened in this matter, to provide you with sort of a cautionary tale around that issue. Some of them are very, real monetary concerns. I mean, in the present matter, one of the concerns, obviously, with rewriting an agreement is it disturbs the certainty provided by them. But there is also the danger of courts effectively dictating expenditures of governments, which happened here. But to add to that, it can have enormous financial implications. So in the George Gordon matter, that was a claim for $10 billion. In the Pasqua matter, that's a claim for $200 million, all based on alleged honorable obligations, which aren't in the agreements and which the government of Saskatchewan did not agree to. If the courts were to in any way agree that these agreements can be rewritten, it would create a clear disincentive for governments to sign them. The other cautionary tale is that any agreement by the court that agreements can be rewritten in any way would only spurn more litigation, particularly if honorable obligations can be sourced in a federal policy. There is a federal policy in relation to treaty land entitlement. And if an honorable obligation burdening a province can be sourced therein, we will definitely see more TLE litigation where claimants will base their claims on the federal TLE policy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Krista Empton.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. The Attorney General of Alberta intervenes in this matter to address the role of the Honour of the Crown in interpreting and implementing agreements between the Crown and Indigenous peoples. This court has repeatedly held that negotiation is a preferable way of reconciling state and Aboriginal interests. However, Alberta submits that a lack of legal certainty about how those negotiated agreements are to be interpreted and applied by the court creates legal risk for all parties and may undermine the process of reconciliation. As my friends from Ontario and Saskatchewan have just addressed, there are a number of decisions, including from this court, considering the application of the Honour of the Crown in the context of modern treaties and treaty land entitlement agreements. And as we've heard, in those cases, the court held the Honour of the Crown is engaged in as an interpretive tool, requiring the agreement to be interpreted generously but fairly. However, the Honour of the Crown does not allow for rewriting of the agreement's clear terms. In ordering Canada and Quebec to pay the deficit funding amounts in this case, the Quebec Court of Appeal did not address this line of case authority or the concern that rewriting agreements may undermine certainty and finality, and as a result, may disincentivize negotiations. The Quebec Court of Appeal also did not clearly identify the basis on which it determined that the Honour of the Crown would apply in this case.
One of the twists in this is was, I think, made more clear by the submissions on behalf of the Crown in Right of Canada, that by declaring something to be relating to reconciliation or whatever, it thereby becomes a question of the honor of the crown, and thereby a further set of obligations is imposed upon the province. Is this a matter of concern, or have I misunderstood that?
It is a matter of concern, Justice Rowe, and I will be addressing this split between the federal crown and the provincial crown as I proceed with my submissions, and addressing this issue of how the honor of the crown applies here. The court in this case, as I said, referenced what it termed as the solemn undertakings to fund contained in the federal First Nations policing policy. But the court also made no reference to this court's findings in Manitoba Métis Federation that the honor of the crown is engaged by constitutional obligations or solemn promises intended to create legal obligations of the highest order, such as treaty promises. It's Alberta's submission the federal policy is not a constitutional document. It's not a treaty within the meaning of Manitoba Métis. It is not a statutory affirmation within the meaning of the recent child welfare reference. Alberta submits the federal policy is not a document that gives rise to solemn promises engaging the honor of the crown. The Quebec Court of Appeal also did not explain how the solemn undertakings it identified in the federal policy could take precedence over the undertakings the parties subsequently agreed to in the signed tripartite funding agreements, or how the federal policy statements could be binding on the provincial crown. It appears rather than contracting out of obligations in this case, the province was contracting into the obligations in the tripartite agreements. And Alberta submits that in such circumstances, the province's obligation should be assessed in light of its specific authority and any express commitments it has made.
I think you are arguing on the merit of this case.
Oh, okay. I apologize, Chief Justice. I will move on with my submissions. The Quebec Court of Appeal decision has implications for collaborative processes well beyond those related to First Nations. Provinces enter into agreements with Canada and Aboriginal groups in a variety of contexts. In the recent child welfare reference case, this court noted there are areas where cooperation is required by the federal and provincial governments to address issues relating to Aboriginal peoples. This court also acknowledged that provinces may have differing views than Parliament on issues such as the scope of Section 35, and may challenge Parliament's understanding.
May I intervene and ask this question? You say in your factum that declaratory relief avoids an unacceptable intrusion into government decision-making. And I guess I'm just wondering about the models of thought that you're using there. I mean, if we're talking about agreements, isn't it the proper role of a court to come up with compensatory damages if such agreements, which are voluntarily acceded to by a government and bind the government by act of the government, why should a court not deal with those agreements as the voluntary undertakings that they are?
Thank you, Madam Justice. I think that Alberta's position is in relation to if the honor of the crown is found to be applicable here, that it may be the case that in the circumstances, the most appropriate relief would be to leave it to the parties and provide some declarations that might provide structure to how the legal rules apply here and how they should be approaching, especially as we have agreements that we've heard are regularly renegotiated. So it's a bit of an ongoing conversation between the First Nations and the Crown. And it may be that declaratory relief may provide some certainty and some guidelines moving forward in those future conversations.
Thank you very much. Marie-Ève Dumont.
Mesdames, Messieurs les juges.
Justices, the AFNQL submits that the honor of the crown combines with the duty of good faith and leads to an elevated standard of conduct duty on the part of the crown. Canada and Quebec must negotiate tripartite agreements in order to achieve political objectives, but with openness and intelligence. During the agreements, if the terms do not enable the achievement of the objective, then it goes against the honor of the crown and opens the way to compensatory damages. So first of all, when it comes to acting in good faith, this court reminded us in Ponce that good faith is informed by the context and the relationship between parties. And a crucial element is policy and its contents and the legitimate expectations that it creates for First Nations, especially when it comes to the funding provided by the federal government and the province. And I'll come back to this. There's also an absence of room for maneuver on the part of the First Nation that has no choice but to accept an offer, even if it is insufficient. It is characterized by the very contract, by the Police Act, that, and this was recognized by the Attorney General of Quebec, that provides that police officers in an Indigenous police force are agents of the peace, like in any other police force, and by the fact that there is a recognition of the underfunding of Indigenous police services, such as in the Vien report. So as I said earlier, this is all founded on a policy and what it provides for in terms of funding. And we submit that 4.5.2 of the agreement, Ms. Dumont, you're arguing as if you're a party, but you're an intervener. You have to speak about this in a general manner. There are excellent lawyers acting on behalf of the parties, both parties, and it's their job. It's not the role of the intervener to do so. We repeat this frequently, but it seems difficult for people to understand. Chief Justice, I take note of your comments, and of course, the last thing I want to do is make any comments on the facts of the case. My point is simply that all First Nations in Quebec that have their own police forces conclude, come to agreements under the auspices of the Police Act and must keep in mind what the objective of the Act is. And so my intent here is to raise the contextual elements that we believe are important to help us understand the extent of the Crown's good faith when it signs tripartite agreements with First Nations that have their own police forces. And what we suggest is that when you read the policy, there is nothing in the policy that suggests that First Nations should run deficits in order to operate, especially not year after year. And therefore, when the Crown negotiates tripartite agreements, it must take into account the objectives of the policy and avoid putting a First Nation before a fait accompli. And that brings me to compensatory damages. In the absence of negotiation where the true needs of a First Nation are taken into account, there's a good chance that the First Nation will have to run deficits in order to operate, or will have to take funding from other sources and therefore reduce the services that it can offer its members. We believe that means there is a direct consequence to the breach of the Crown's duty of honor, and therefore the Crown must pay for the harm that is suffered. We believe that it is a harm created by a breach of the Crown's duty to act with honor. And to finish, I would like to come back to what some attorney generals have said, saying that judicial relief is the only possible reparation. We submit respectfully that that would mean that when the honor of the crown is engaged, no matter what the circumstances are, First Nations could receive a less generous remedy. Thank you.
Are we?
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. The Congress of Aboriginal Peoples, which I will refer to as CAP throughout my submissions. Its position before you today is that the Honour of the Crown is engaged in agreements of this type as a manifestation of the Crown's solemn commitment to facilitate Indigenous self-governance. And that should this court uphold the finding by the court below that that duty is engaged, it should not use this opportunity to limit it unduly in a manner that would disadvantage Indigenous peoples who are non-resident on First Nations.
So is the criteria the nature of the agreement, or is it some some declaration made by, for example, the Crown and Right of Canada, that this is a promise of a certain nature which attracts the honour of the Crown? Because if it's in the nature of the agreement that one should determine this, then it is an objective matter. Whereas if it is a function of the declaration of the federal government, then it is deemed. I mean, we it's almost as if we have to accept their characterization.
Justice Rowe, thank you for the question. I think, I hate to give you this answer, but I think it is in fact both. I think there are agreements, the nature of which are either explicitly or implicitly intended to facilitate self-government. In this case, I understand the court seems concerned about the binding of Quebec by the commitment of Canada to this inherent right of self-government. However, in this case, I think we had some comments from the panel yesterday about the importance of context. And so we have here both an explicit commitment by Canada. We also have a commitment by the National Assembly of Quebec adopting legislation or adopting resolutions recognizing the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous People in that province. That in and of itself is a commitment to the right of self-government and self-determination. And of course, we have in this case the decision of the Quebec Court of Appeal in reference, which we've talked about today, which is binding in the courts in Quebec that this inherent right of self-government exists and is a Section 35 right.
So perhaps perhaps you've put your finger on it then. I mean, there's going to be issues to be worked out in future cases. Reconciliation is a very broad tent, if you will, in terms of types of agreements that would promote reconciliation. But in this case, in some cases it may be that there's a Section 35, an established Section 35 right, and then the agreement seeks to promote that. In that context, of course, it would be clear. But one doesn't need to actually find an established Section 35 right. If the agreement seeks to promote self-government, whether or not recognized as a Section 35 right, that clearly would, you say, get over the bar to trigger the obligation of the honor of the crown. There may be other cases that promote reconciliation, broadly speaking, that fall short of that. But in this case, it's clearly above the bar. And we can't really say definitively what would be sufficient, because that will need to be worked out.
Thank you, Justice Dumas. And I agree. I think in this case, perhaps you've also put your finger on it, which is that the heart of the honor of the crown is, as we know from Manitoba Métis Federation, that the government must honor its solemn commitments. And I suppose we can have some debates in the law about what that solemnity means. But where you have a commitment in legislation, a commitment to an international instrument, a commitment in statute, and case law that applies, I think in my submission on behalf of the Congress, that these are the types of commitments which engage the duty that is inherent in Canada's relationship with its Indigenous people. And I see that I have taken up most of my time, so I will wrap up by saying that should the court uphold the duty in this case, I would caution it to be very mindful of the interests of officer and non-status peoples, as it was recently in this court's decision in Dixon, which is to not unduly limit it and to permit those who live off reserve to also in future develop the principles of the honor of the crown.
Thank you very much. Nick Saunders.
May it please the court, Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Canada. I'm appearing with my co-counsel Carly Fox on behalf of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, which represents 62 First Nations. The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs' position is that we are respectfully asking this court to advance reconciliation by clarifying the nature of the Crown's sui generis fiduciary duty, specifically its application beyond First Nation interests. And the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs submits that specific interests integral to the inherent right to self-government constitute cognizable First Nation interests. These interests must not be confined to the interests flowing from rights recognized under Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982. Courts have narrowly construed First Nation inherent rights, imposing an impractical standard of proof of self-government rights. The narrow interpretation of these rights in courts is contrary to both First Nations perspectives and the standards recognized under the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This court has long recognized First Nations in interests in land as distinct from the Section 35 framework capable of grounding a sui generis fiduciary duty. Interests inherent to First Nation sovereignty do not need to be proven under Section 35 to be affirmed as valid. The undeniable connection between sovereignty and land interests underscores the need for a broader recognition of First Nation interests. A cognizable First Nation interest is one that is capable of recognition. The historical recognition of pre-existing First Nation sovereignty through treaty making, the Crown demonstrates recognition of First Nations governing interests. Further, First Nation sovereignty interests are inherently collective and tied to First Nations unique identities and deep connections to the land and encompass both collective and cultural dimensions. This court has recognized that such collective interests are connected to cultural difference, prior occupancy, and sovereignty, meriting constitutional protection beyond Section 35. Secondly, over the last 150 years, the Crown's unilateral and dishonorable conduct subjected nearly all facets of the inherent right to self-government to adverse Crown discretion. Historical influence of laws like the Indian Act and aggressive policies systematically disadvantaged First Nations, hindering their capacity for genuine self-governance. This control, exemplified by practices such as the residential school system, perpetuates discriminatory and obstructs Indigenous self-determination, which is further evidenced by findings from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. Thirdly, this court has recognized the sui generis fiduciary duty, a vital component of the relationship between First Nations and the Crown, serving to reconcile the Crown's assertion of sovereignty with the enduring sovereignty of First Nations. Clarifying that the scope of the sui generis fiduciary duty encompasses a broader range of First Nation interests aligns with the evolving jurisprudence of this court and with the principles of justice and reconciliation. A broader application of the sui generis fiduciary duty is essential for advancing reconciliation, providing enforceable remedies which promotes accountability and fairness in the Crown. Unlike the honor of the Crown, a breach of fiduciary duty constitutes an independent cause of action which allows for judicial intervention when negotiations fail. An enforceable fiduciary duty balances the power dynamics inherent in the relationship. While the honor of the Crown assumes the Crown will act honorably without judicial intervention, a premise unfortunately not shown historically or held to be true by many First Nations. Further, the sui generis fiduciary duty, unlike an ad hoc fiduciary duty, also enables the Crown to consider both its public law duties and its fiduciary duty to First Nations when making decisions, facilitating a more balanced approach. In conclusion, historical context, ongoing challenges faced by First Nations necessitates robust recognition of inherent rights to government. The Crown's historical and continued discretionary control over these rights require a broad application of sui generis fiduciary duty. This expansion not only aligns with evolving legal principles, but also serves as an important mechanism for advancing reconciliation and addressing systemic injustices. Therefore, we respectfully urge this court to embrace a more expansive interpretation of the fiduciary duty owed by the Crown to First Nations, thereby upholding principles of justice and fairness. Those are my submissions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julian Faulkner.
Good morning, Justices. The Indigenous Police Chiefs of Ontario is honored to have the opportunity to make submissions before you. Of course, we do not make submissions in respect of the outcome of the appeal. We respectfully furnish this analysis as informed by the specialized expertise as referred to by Justice Rowe in respect of being police chiefs of the 9 self-administered police services in the province of Ontario. The Akwesasne Mohawk Police Service, the Anishinaabeg Police Service, the Lac Seul Police Service, the Anishinaabe-Aski Police Service, the Rama Police Service, the Six Nations Police Service, the Treaty 3 Police Service, the UCCM Anishinaabeg Police Service, and the Wequemequong Police Service, all urge that any analysis in respect of the FNIPP program be one infused with an air of reality. Now, what does an error of reality mean? The specialized expertise of the Indigenous Police Chiefs of Ontario is relied upon to say that it means first and foremost to recognize that it is absolutely an imbalance of power, that permeating each and every discussion that results in a funding agreement is an utter imbalance of power that results in it what it can only be described as a take it or leave it discussion. Now, this reality has been not only been recognized by the Quebec Court of Appeal in the instant matter, but is actually recognized by the Auditor General in the most recent report that was filed before this court in sections 3.6 and 3.7. This imbalance of power and this take it or leave it approach was recognized by Justice Gaskell in the judgment of Indigenous Police Chiefs of Ontario versus Public Safety, which is cited in our factum being paragraph 22. I want to emphasize again, in terms of looking at the question of imbalance of power, first and foremost, the discussion yesterday around the deficit provision is a perfect example. The BCRs that are on this record, the band council resolutions on this record, that say they are signing under duress in order to keep policing in their communities is a perfect example. But what happened and is recited in the decision by Mr. Justice Gaskell of the federal court, a decision issued just last June, is that three services faced, Anishinaabeg Police Service, Treaty 3 Police Service, and UCCM, faced with the terms and conditions that required them to refrain from expending funds on legal counsel to advise them on interpreting the funding agreement, that required them, barred them from having specialized units such as a domestic assault unit or a homicide unit. Terms and conditions of this program that preclude them from financing infrastructure. When they finally said enough is enough, we are not going to sign these, the response of Public Safety, and it's set out in the reasons of Justice Gaskell, was take it or leave it. There can be no doubt that what is at stake in respect of the determination as to whether honor of the crown applies to the entirety of this process, including the province, what is at stake is whether, in essence, Indigenous people will literally be left in the cold. The specialized expertise of IPCO is such that it recognizes that the word policing doesn't capture what is at stake here. What is at stake here is the safety and well-being of the community members. What is at stake here is the health of Indigenous people. This court in February recognized in the Bill C-92 case the extraordinary interconnectedness between all the different forms of oppression on Indigenous people that have landed Canada in the situation it is. A situation in which Indigenous people are horribly disadvantaged, whether we are talking about health, education, whether we are discussing realities of child welfare, that it is all connected. And so leaving Indigenous people without negotiations clothed in honor of the crown essentially leaves a major area of security imperiled.
May I ask you this question? In terms of the submissions that you're making, we have a policy from the federal government that clearly sets out an equal service model and comparable communities. Are you saying that even if there wasn't that in the policy of the federal government, that you're reading those same kind of obligations into what you say the honor of the crown requires in this context?
In a nutshell, Justice Martin, yes. But there is a but with this. In my respectful submission, because Canada chose to enunciate a policy that states that, and Quebec in this case, and Ontario in the Gascon-Jay decision, chose to partner up on the policy, we don't have to go that extra mile, in my respectful submission. They have determined, quite rightly, dating back to the 1990s, and may I observe as follows, that policy created in 1992 was amended as a result of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples report. So I say only this in closing, that leaving this unaddressed, leaving an absence of honor of the crown in all components, will leave these communities stuck once again to fend for themselves in a fashion wholly inconsistent with reconciliation. And right. I thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Naomi Metelik.
Chief Justice, Justices, I will focus on two questions that permeated discussions yesterday. First, the nature of the obligations in cases like this, and second, whether this court can rely on private law principles alone. This case is representative of the programming and funding approach to essential services, which the Crown has routinely employed in other areas like child and family services. The conduct in this case has been happening across Canada, most recently in negotiating coordination agreements under the Act upheld in the C-92 reference. This causes active harm to First Nations communities, children, and families. It has persisted because there is a lack of clear judicial guidance on the parameters of Crown conduct. This court can provide such guidance by being clear about which duties are in play and when these duties are breached. If you turn to the outline of submissions in our condensed book, different stages of the programming and funding approach engage different but well-established duties. At the promise stage, the Crown makes a promise that it will work with First Nations so that they can oversee their own effective, culturally appropriate essential service, generally tied to Crown recognition of self-government. In the C-92 reference, the court identified such a promise in legislation. In other cases, the promise could be anchored in a formal policy or could flow from a provincial act authorizing funding agreements with First Nations. Solemn promises of this nature attract a duty of diligent implementation. And to connect to the questions from Justice Kazurer and the discussion with Justice Jamal, we would point to our submissions at our brief at paragraphs 14 to 20, where we do set out the three-part approach laid out in Manitoba Métis Federation and how we say that it is met in this case. But it is along the lines of what Justice Jamal
previously laid out. Are these obligations of the Crown to which you refer common to the Crown in right of Canada and in right of the provinces? Are they entirely coextensive? Can one party impose obligations on the other? This undifferentiated use of the Crown, I find very imprecise.
Justice Rowe, I would say, well, that both Canada and the provinces have obligations to provide essential public services to First Nations. In terms of imposing, I would say that that question does not necessarily have to be answered in a case like this where you have a party who has acceded to complying with a policy.
Ms. Metelik, you quite properly are trying to identify the obligation, and you say in this case, or in cases like this, there are agreements, you call them solemn agreements. But perhaps the obligation is broader because there is a protective jurisdiction of governments in respect of Indigenous people. Obviously, promoting self-government is an important policy imperative to promote reconciliation. But the jurisdiction to protect and to provide protection is broader than what may be implemented in a particular agreement. Certainly in respect of the federal government in its 9124 jurisdiction, that seems to me to be undeniable. That can't be contracted out of. And in respect of the province, to Justice Rowe's point that one has to differentiate, there are, it seems to me, a bit of a double aspect of the protective jurisdiction, because indigenous people are people inside the province. So is that a broader basis upon which one can sort of identify the source of what the obligation is, which is given a particular illustration when there is an agreement, but it's broader than simply a particular agreement?
Yes, and I think drawing it to the double aspect nature of these types of services is a good way to see it. Continuing on, we will just say that we do not think that this duty constitutionalizes the promise, but so long as promises remain in effect, the duty of diligence operates as an implied term. You have our submissions as well. I see that I'm running quite low on time, but you have our submissions where we also break down that the duty of honorable negotiation can apply to the funding agreement stage, and we do believe that this is key, as well as that the negotiation and renewal stages provide a way to see the honor of the crown applying to guide in terms of contractual exercises of contractual discretion.
Thank you very much. Claire Truesdale.
Chief Justice, Justices, when the Crown asserted sovereignty and took de facto control over First Nations territories, confining them to reserves, it deprived First Nations of the means to support their ongoing autonomous governance. The honor of the Crown must be engaged by Crown First Nation funding arrangements for services on these reserves. In Manitoba Métis, this court said the duty that flows from the honor of the Crown varies with the situation in which it is engaged, and that it is not engaged in all circumstances. We must look first to the context surrounding the Crown conduct to understand whether the honor of the Crown is engaged, and if it is, then examine the specific Crown conduct to determine what duty flows from it. Justice Rowe, you asked my friend, is it the nature of the agreement or Canada's declaration about it that triggers the duty? And we say it's the former. We have to look to the effect of the conduct, the agreement and the negotiations here, to determine whether the honor of the Crown applies. Otherwise, the Crown could avoid constitutional obligations simply by avoiding magic words like self-government. I'll focus on two indications that the honor of the Crown is engaged in Crown First Nation funding arrangements. First, the honor of the Crown is engaged when Crown conduct stands to affect the reconciliation of pre-existing Indigenous societies with asserted Crown sovereignty. We see examples of this type of conduct in the case law on treaty negotiation, interpretation and implementation, and other solemn promises. But Crown First Nation funding arrangements also stand to affect this reconciliation. They are necessary because the assertion of Crown sovereignty and de facto control over lands and resources deprives First Nations of the means to fully fund their own governments as independent nations. This clearly links the agreements to self-government, regardless of whether any law, policy, or agreement says so explicitly. These arrangements can address, at least in part, the resourcing gap created by the process of colonization. They support a nation's move towards fuller self-government by freeing up more of the nation's own funds to build capacity for the future. They can also establish the responsibilities of each government with respect to service provision, including the First Nations' control over or input into how services are administered and delivered. These are clear effects on self-government. And with respect to your comment earlier today, Justice Jamal, we agree that that's the case whether self-government is recognized as a Section 35 right or not. Self-government is clearly part of an Indigenous society. It's part of what being a society means. And so given that the honor of the Crown arises from reconciliation between Crown sovereignty and Indigenous societies, self-government is clearly a part of that. and we don't need to recognize it as a Section 35 right in order for the honor of the crown to arise. Second, the honor of the crown is engaged when crown conduct stands to affect specific Aboriginal interests, like a band's interest in its reserve lands. And we see this in case law on crown decisions affecting reserves where the honor of the crown can give rise to a fiduciary duty. The court in Southwind recognized that reserve lands are at the center of the relationship between crown and First Nations. They are set aside under the Indian Act for a band's use and benefit, and in the face of de facto crown control over the rest of their territories, provide a limited land base protected from non-Indigenous exploitation on which to live, build an economy, and maintain cultural identity and well-being. Funding arrangements directly affect a First Nation's ability to continue on these reserve lands. Without adequate essential services like policing, a First Nation cannot derive the full benefit of its reserve for residential, economic, and cultural purposes. Funding arrangements for on-reserve services thus arise from this unique history and contemporary reality of Crown First Nation relations. They are not purely administrative. While First Nation members are entitled to services substantively equal to others in Canada, they also have collective rights as Indigenous peoples and a distinct relationship with the Crown, and the application of the honor of the Crown to these arrangements would properly recognize this. With respect to remedies, we say there's a broad range of remedies available for breach of duties flowing from the honor of the Crown, and I'll just refer you to paragraph 12 of our factum where we list some of those. And those include declarations, but declarations should not displace remedies otherwise available based on general remedial principles. And where the breach of a duty results in a quantifiable loss for an Indigenous people or an ill-gotten gain for the Crown, damages may be appropriate.
Thank you very much. Julie McGregor.
Yes, good morning. I would like to begin by acknowledging the territory of the court, that the court sits on the unceded territory of the Algonquin people. Yesterday, the court made an interesting statement saying that context exists and we cannot ignore it. The context of First Nations policing is that it's in crisis. There have been numerous tragedies across First Nations resulting in thousands of recommendations from coroner's inquest and commissions of inquiry in relation to First Nations people in the justice system. They all call for greater culturally appropriate First Nations policing, but the reality is that First Nations policing is severely underfunded. Yesterday, the court questioned whether First Nations could use autonomous revenue to cover off funding deficits under funding agreements, and I would like to provide greater context with respect to that question. First Nations, as you've already heard from a few interveners, are underfunded across the board, whether that be health services, education, housing, and many of the other social services. This court recently released its decision in the C-92 reference case. That piece of legislation, C-92, came about because of decades of findings of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal that First Nations are severely underfunded with respect to child welfare. Policing, of course, the matter before you was determined by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal to also have been underfunded. If a First Nation is expected to cover deficits with respect to its funding, it means that First Nations people go without housing, education, health services, and so forth. It is an absolute injustice that First Nations must manage their poverty in one of the richest countries in the world. So how do we remedy this situation? Well, it starts with the recognition of self-governance and the right of First Nations to determine what their own needs are with respect to policing. We heard yesterday about self-governance in terms of the Policing Act, the First Nations Policing Program, and funding agreements, all with the goal of enhancing or recognizing self-governance. But the context to that is that much greater. The essence of self-governance, we submit to you, is that it is an inherent right, recognized and affirmed by Section 35. And not just by Section 35, but also under the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People in Article 4, which is also in turn recognized by Canadian domestic law under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. We submit to you that narrowing self-governance to a set of goals in a policy or terms of an agreement ignores the history of First Nations people as self-governing before contact and the continuing and how they continue to self-govern to this day with limited resources to do so. But it also ignores the greater context of the Crown's relationship with First Nations people. Yesterday, we also heard from a question of whether the honor of the Crown needs to be invoked and whether it's or whether we could just look at it as a failure of negotiate in good faith. This court in Mikisew Cree said that the purpose of the honor of the Crown is reconciliation. Reconciliation is not determining the Crown's obligation. It's not the Crown itself determining its obligations and whether it's breached them based upon an agreement it unilaterally created and implemented to the exclusion of the First Nations based upon an arbitrary administration of a policy. Again, the source is the relationship. That is the context. In the brief time I have, I just want to sort of touch on remedies. There has been questions with respect to what are the appropriate remedies in this case. And without alluding to a determination or making submissions on the determination of the case, we would say that there is, again, as has already been said, an array of remedies that could be available, declarations among them. However, we would say that the greater context in this scenario is that there are 36 First Nations, self-administered First Nations police forces across Canada, all in a similar circumstance as Ms. Duwiash. And there has to be some sort of, if it is determined that a remedy should be imposed, it has to be, there has to be a measure of deterrence with respect to conduct to ensure that First Nations are not continually having to bring up cases like the one before you with respect to the funding and the damages or the losses that they incur. Those are my submissions, Miigwech.
Thank you very much. Réplique, Maître Dupré.
Reply, Ms. Dupré. I'd like to quickly return to the issue of honor of the crown. In Manitoba Métis, paragraph 73, about honor of the crown, it says it is not a cause of action but a principle that has to do with the terms of execution of duties. So what I'd like to focus on is the fact that it's worth retracing the obligation that would lead to analyzing the terms of the obligation. So we need to analyze the mode of execution of obligations. Manitoba Métis broadened beyond Section 35 the application of honor of the crown to a situation that was not covered by 35, but a constitutional circumstance. And this was already a broadening of the concept of honor of the crown in paragraph 81 of the decision of the judgment. Justice Karakatsanis wrote that duty was of a restricted scope. Question: do you accept that the principle of honor of the crown applies outside of the context of Section 35? Answer: it can apply, but it must be attached to a constitutional obligation because the very principle is founded on the reference, and this court said so. Honor of the crown is attached to the Constitution. It is a constitutional principle, and its foundation is affirming sovereignty on the pre-existing presence of Indigenous peoples. And so this is a right that refers to the fact that Indigenous peoples existed on this land beforehand. That is the very principle underlying honor of the crown. Question: in our reference on C-92, Indigenous Services to Children, this court concluded that the federal act was constitutional because it allowed Indigenous peoples to have a better system to manage that issue. What do you say to that? Answer: I don't see any contradiction because, and obviously I don't want to explain your own decision to you, but my understanding of it is that it is founded on the issue of sovereignty. We're looking at a policy and an agreement, whereas in the reference, the fact that the federal government must act as if the honor of the crown is engaged, you do use that term, as if the honor of the crown was engaged, implies, first of all, that Parliament has to have expressed its understanding of Section 35. And there are several places in the reference where this court indicates that the federal government has to act as if the honor of the crown is engaged and not that the honor of the crown is indeed engaged. And in paragraph 7118, 97 and 60, it says that this court looks at the issue of whether the declaration, the fact that the federal government explains its understanding of self-government would be protected under Section 35. This court says that this understanding does not bind courts or provinces depending on the interpretation. So I don't see a contradiction. Question. Ms. Dupré, I'd like to ask you a question that your friend discussed yesterday. It has to do with the nature of the deficits run by the First Nation. And I have a question. I'm in your alternative argument. I'd like to understand the issue of compensatory damages that would be the same as the amount of the deficit, as Justice Bish said. So to understand the nature of the deficit, the deficits, your friend looked at the evidence and said, if I understood correctly, that there's no evidence that the First Nation mismanaged the money. In other words, the deficit was not the result of bad management by the employer of the police officers. And if I understand correctly, the deficits were not caused by unreasonable, unnecessary expenses by the First Nation to ensure comparable police services to neighboring communities. Could you tell us what your reading is of the nature of the deficit and this loss on the part of the First Nation? Answer, what the evidence shows us is that there was an arbitration award that covered the majority of the deficit, but in its operation, the deficit, according to the evidence and what the trial judge concluded, and this is at paragraph 62 to 65 of the Superior Court decision, we know that in the agreement, the Indigenous police forces manage the police services, and there's no level of service laid out such as what we see in the Police Act. And as I said yesterday, when you compare the services, it doesn't necessarily have to be what you see in the policy. There's a clause in the agreement that I identified yesterday, and I will refer you to Mr. Venya's testimony, tab 4, paragraphs 24 and 25, where it is clear that there is room for maneuver. They do have the possibility of making all sorts of decisions when it comes to the level of service. But the service, the level of service that Mastoyash chose to provide was almost level one service. And therefore, as the trial judge said, the service that the Crown's intended to offer is not the same as the service that is offered by Master Yesh, which is at a higher level. Question, I have a question about the policy, just to confirm your client's position. Is your client's position inaudible? If I look at the issue of funding, page 8, that says the First Nation must pay for part of the costs, that would not apply? Answer, well, you have to look at the policy as a whole. If it applies, it applies as a whole. And if the provision is in there, then it applies. But if it does not apply to us, then Quebec's contribution, as I said, and maybe this will allow me to talk about Section 90 of the Police Act. It introduces an exception to the Police Act because small communities cannot, under the Act, benefit from police forces. So there is an exception that is a reconciliation measure and allows Indigenous communities, no matter what the population is, to benefit from their services. The exception falls under tripartite agreements, but it is tripartite. In the agreement, there are obligations. Question, your time is up, but I have a last question. In the renewals, did Quebec ever raise the fact that Quebec could pay more to justify, could not pay more because to justify the reason why their amount was not increased? Answer, no. For decades, the agreement has been that anything beyond government contributions falls into a deficit that must be paid for by the community. And if you'll allow me to say one last thing, I know that yesterday you were concerned with the quantity and quality of the service. Given the level of service and the option of calling upon the Sûreté du Québec for complimentary services, there is no issue in that regard. And I would refer you to tab 4, Mr. Vanier's testimony, page 19, where he says calls are answered in record time and the population feels safe. Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We will take this case under advisement. Thank you.